Sorry.
Welcome to the B-Side, episode number 15, Twasson Lights Church podcast.
Super Bowl edition.
Super Bowl edition.
The super edition.
I am totally the wrong host for this edition. It's so funny, we're meeting in Steve's office. Oh, with me, it's Rhoda Brooks.
Hi, Rhoda.
And, yeah, and Tyler Crawford.
Who are the two teams that play in the Super Bowl? Rhoda.
Go!
Denver Broncos and the Seattle Seahawks.
Well done.
Name one player.
No, stop that.
Name one player from either team.
Peyton Manning.
Whoa. Of the?
Broncos.
Wow.
And one Seattle Seahawk?
I can't do it. All I know is from, like, Facebook news feeds. Okay, so this is what I say. I'm the wrong host for the show.
Were you at church on Sunday?
Yes.
When Steve referenced what jersey I was wearing? Do you not even remember
that? No, because
that?
I was in children's ministry.
Okay. Richard Sherman.
I was doing the Lord's work while you guys were talking about football.
Football is the Lord's work. Saving souls.
So you had a jersey on, and today you're wearing a shirt that says "We Are 12," and yeah. I had to ask you what that meant.
It's not a reference to his age. The way that I am.
It's about the 12th man.
I like that it's also plural. We are 12. Like, there's multiple personalities going on there at the same time.
No, it's just when you get a 2X, that's it. Extra large and lower is I am 12, but a 2X says we are 12. That was a pretty good one, eh? Who's thought of that?
Hey, Tyler, explain the real meaning behind We Are 12.
Well, most people would know that it's about the 12th man of the Seahawks.
Essentially, it's like a disciple shirt.
Sure. but there isn't a betrayer. or a savior. So it's just 12 dudes hanging out, I guess. No, it's there's 11 people that play on a football field. And the idea behind the 12th man is that the fan base is the 12th man. They can have an impact on the outcome of the game. I've had the privilege of being the 12th man at like CenturyLink Field in Seattle for a game. Just in December, I went down with two of my friends for the Monday night game against the Saints, and it was crazy. Like the other time was years ago. Just to give context how loud it was, like, I had earplugs in the whole game.
Wow.
And the drive home, my ears did not stop ringing till Marysville.
Wow.
Like an hour north of Seattle. So it's pretty chaotic. But yeah, those Seahawks
set a record this year for.
Yeah, they set a few. They've broken world records.
Yeah.
Like on multiple occasions.
Loudest crowd.
And then some people would say they've caused earthquakes, but they've actually registered seismic activity.
Really?
With the level of their noise, like 1.6. on the Richter scale, at a couple of key points in Seahawk history. There's a little part of me that's skeptical about that. Seems a bit far-fetched, but there's a seismology meter or whatever just down the block from Quest Field.
Hmm.
And so there's a couple of key points. There's like a couple of Marshawn Lynch's, their running backs, runs, and one of them happened at the game that I was at on December 2nd or 3rd against the Saints, and then one against the Niners on the 19th, which happened to be my birthday. So let's talk more about myself. And then there was one from a couple years ago against the Saints where that was the first time. So essentially the idea is that the 12th man can have and will have an impact.
And the 12th man is basically the collective fan.
Yeah, the fan base, yeah.
All the fans in the stand are collectively the 12th player.
Yeah, so though some people will wear the 12th man jersey. There's a 12th man flag they'll raise. They'll have a Seattle, local Seattle or Washington State celebrity often, or Pacific Northwest, raised a 12th man flag for every game. It's woven into the fabric of the team. And the genius behind it is, from what I know, it was an organic movement that started.
This sounds like, okay, this is a bizarre anyway, yeah, organic.
So that it kind of started within the fan base in the 80s. And then somewhere in the 90s, or I don't know, I could be correct on this, but...
The team actually went, wait a second.
Yeah, like, this is genius. And just got on board with it, and it's taken off, and it's... no other team in pro sports has... It, like, well, I guess it would rival, like, the Red Sox Nation. Like they talk about Red Sox Nation or Yankee Nation, that there's kind of fan bases that are this collective and they have a name. With the Seahawks, it's the 12th
but
man.
Do you remember when the Canucks
tried
to do the seventh man? It was a couple, I can't remember, a few
I
years
don't
ago.
Remember it, but I think it there's a reason.
Yeah.
Like it didn't stand out.
Gillis did try to, yeah, they tried to do it. I think he would just try to plain old copy it. I remember it was the beginning of a season. And they, I think it was only lasted like two home games. They had a season ticket holder raise the seventh man banner, and everyone was supposed to be left. But it totally bombed. Everyone was like, this is the worst idea. Just because it was very forced. It was a copycat, and it was like non-organic. It was just kind of came from the marketing guys.
Well, you know, we're British Columbians.
It was
we like things
2008.
Yeah. Oh. It was like, I think, Gillis's first year. Maybe I'm misremembering that.
Well, I know it's a big
deal. But
it's
like two games.
So I'm not a football fan. So I didn't watch the game, but I know it was a big deal because they won their it was their first.
First ever, yeah.
And they won it by like a landslide.
Yeah.
And I have to love some of the Canadian football fans I know posting, like, this is so Canadian, but at some point, like, people are posting, is there not a mercy rule? And they're rooting for the Seahawks, but they actually feel like it's too mean. And I'm like, how so Canadian of us, right? Yeah. So I didn't watch it. I'm very happy for them, though. I actually played football in high school. I don't watch it now. I like to play it, but I was middle linebacker and right tackle, actually. And my mom came to watch my games, and all she could do was yell in the stands and go, don't hurt anybody. She's never worried about me being hurt.
You don't kind of give off a right tackle type of vibe.
Did you protect the blind side of the quarterback?
All I know is that my blind favorite part of the game is I got to put on equipment and, like, take people out. It was exhilarating. I really actually loved it. And my mom knew that because that's why she always yelled, because she was never worried about me getting hurt. She's only worried about me hurting other people's children.
So, speaking of which, the seventh man. I'm finding out information here. It debuted in, when was the season kickoff? October?
Yeah.
So it debuted October 2008. And there's an article here dated November 17th, 2008. Seventh man, rest in peace. And essentially, it's unofficial. It's just saying that, you've never heard of it. So essentially, it didn't.
I think they launched it, and then it just ended one day, and then they just sort of pretended it didn't happen.
Yeah.
Because it was a marketing flop.
There you go.
Yeah. Now I'm really interested, so I'm just reading the article.
Okay, well, I'm going to move on to a question while you're reading that.
Speaking
of that, last week we've had lots of good questions sent in. We still won't get through all our questions today, which is an excellent problem. But we started talking about, we had questions sent in about children or babies who are born before, let's say, conversion or public declaration.
They're all
age.
Born before conversion.
Yeah, that's true.
Die? You mean die?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean die.
You're on your before. Game today.
Woo! So,
you're like Peyton Manning out there.
Oh, my goodness. I need to go get my football equipment back on. Okay, so we had some questions sent in that we addressed last week about age of accountability, things like that, and we didn't get through that whole group's questions. Those questions were actually sent in by a community group, which was great. Hello. So I'm going to go on to the next question from that community group, which has to do, with the mercy rule, I don't know, but... This one is in Abide, which is our kind of set out Bible reading for the church if people are following a Bible reading program. We have one on our website that is referred to as Abide. And it says, we are reading Joshua in Abide right now, and many people, including children, were killed just because they weren't on the Israeli side. How can this be explained as more than a genocide? What then becomes the spiritual destiny of those slain children? So obviously it's referencing when the Israelites were going in to claim the promised land and God told them to take the people out in that land.
Including children.
Mm-hmm.
I think I would we'd build off of what we said last week, because a lot of the same things we said last, you know, in those other questions would be really relevant. Like in the end, you know, what's the destiny of those slain children? I really have no idea. But we trust... We don't want to look to something in the kids themselves, or they're innocent or they're not. But we want to look to a God who's merciful and just, who always does the right thing, who in the end no one will be able to complain. Like all mouths will be silenced because we will see the perfect justice and mercy of God. So in the end, I don't know for sure. We know that God will do what is right. and we would guess that if a child is does not have enough revelation, that they would be able to suppress the truth and reject God, that they haven't had that opportunity, then that they would likely be saved by God's mercy.
Not because of their merit.
Not because they're innocent, but because they, you know, all the things we talked about last week would still apply as far as that, I would say. Like, so we want to look to God's mercy and to know that. I think whenever we think of, like, the Canaanite, you know, taking the promised land and wiping out the Canaanites, we have to often people's starting place is we start in a place of morality and then view God's actions based on our feelings and go, how can God be good if he acts in a way that I wouldn't act, right? I think we need to start with God and his morality and his righteousness and then work from that to the event. And so I would go, okay, they had to do this. They went in and they did this as per God's command, but God commanded something righteous and good, and it was the right thing to do. If I see a discrepancy between what was done and maybe what I feel would be right, the discrepancies in my head and not God's, and that this action was right to do. And we have to admit that God knows better about an event that happened thousands of years ago that I'm reading in a book that God was there for, that he commanded. He knows that this is the right thing to do more than me.
Well, and I think to build on that, like, it's that whole... I often think about this in context of relationship, even with my wife or people that I know and love, that and I think we've all done this to an extent where somebody does where something's happened or you do something and someone kind of thinks the worst first.
Mm-hmm.
And my response often is, you know, to my wife, like, give me the benefit of the doubt here. Like, you know me, you know, like, you know that I love you. Like, so if this happened or whatever, like, if you fell down, I didn't shove you. We bumped into each other. Like, that was a bad example. I don't abuse my wife, but imagination.
I'm like, where is this going? Yeah,
but in the sense of, like, when we think about God and we think about these stories, we go, I think we often don't give God the benefit of the doubt to recognize that, you know what?
Or we think that we actually are, and more, I have to put myself in this category, we're audacious enough to actually assume that we have higher morality than God does.
Yeah. And so we kind of look at it and we go, like, how could God do this? Whereas on one hand, if I think to myself, like, if God is who he says he is, they had it coming. If God is who he says he was in the right and I'm in the wrong. Like, and so I think part of that is just understanding. I heard a sermon this weekend that just, like, kind of opened this door for me. It was this idea that so often we approach these questions back to front in a way, as we kind of go, well, how can God ... And we kind of inflict, a morality on God that says that if God is good, then he mustn't allow X, Y, and Z. Where on the flip side, the sermon was kind of talking about how it's on us. Like, you know, God didn't make the world this way. Sin entered the world through man. And so the evil that exists in the world is not a result of God allowing it. It's a result of man choosing to do it. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes for me, it comes back to this idea of, like, do we give God the benefit of the doubt? Like, do we trust that he's got this?
I think the a really important passage has helped me understand the killings in Joshua is in Genesis 15. I don't have it here. God is speaking to Abram at the time. This is Genesis 15, verse 13 to 16. It says, he's talking about the promised land and what's to come. And he says, know for certain that your offspring will be sojourners in a land that is not theirs and will be servants there, and they'll be afflicted for 400 years. But I will bring judgment on the nation that they serve, and afterward they shall come out with great possessions. Talking about Egypt, right? As for yourself, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You shall be buried in a good old age. And they shall come back here in the fourth generation, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete. Mm-hmm. So here we have 400 years in advance. God telling Abram, there's going to be a day when your descendants are going to come up out of Egypt, and I'm going to judge Egypt for their sin, and they're going to come up and possess this land, but not yet, because the iniquity, the sin of the Amorites, who are some of the people that lived in Canaan, is not yet complete. Now, it's not it doesn't tell us much, but it tells me enough to say that when the Israelites went into Canaan and started following God's instructions, which they didn't actually, we should point out, they didn't actually completely follow as they should, and they actually reaped the consequences of that years later when they're surrounded by people in the land that they didn't get rid of. But that God was not yet ready to punish them in Abraham's generation. It was hundreds of years later when their sin had reached a level where it was just and right and good for them to be punished in this way, to be eliminated.
Which is interesting, right? Because we're talking about bigger picture now. So you go like, why, if God is good, why can he allow dot, 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 right? But then you see verses of the Lord is patient, he's kind, he's merciful, like he's slow to anger and rich in love. But we are living such finite, short lives. Yeah. We have such a small slice of the picture that unless you go back and you look at that, you see actually how long the Lord waited.
Yeah. So the question, you go, how could God allow, or how could God give the command for Joshua and the army to go in and kill all those innocent people? There's an assumption in there that is a wrong assumption. That is, all those innocent people. Mm-hmm. When actually what we see a peek into the window in Genesis 15, these are not innocent people. And they are completely deserving of God's judgment. And God has been patient with them for hundreds of years to the point where they now, it is appointed time for them to be judged for their sin. And actually historical documents would kind of corroborate. And you can read about the atrocious and horrible things that the Canaanites before Israel got there were doing. And you realize that these are actually a very, very wicked people. So it's not how could God instruct the killing of innocent people is a false dilemma. It's a false question.
And I think that it was following, it was really the question was focused on children. So yes. We've talked about the people as a whole in the context of this. And then going back, if people want to know about children specifically, well, again, only God knows what the hearts and minds of those children are, what they would be, as far as their understanding, then that goes back to the first answer with all children of we don't have that answer, but we trust in God's righteousness and his good judgment. So, but yeah, that was really interesting when you brought up the Genesis passage. That was good for me too. We read the list of sins. Oh, this is the next question. We read the list of sins in Romans 1:29-30. So this question goes back to a couple of weeks ago in your sermon, and you were listing off the list of sins along with slanders, haters of God, etc. You didn't, I think, mention disobedient to parents.
It's on the list, yeah.
Right? Which is on the list. So the question was, do we still need to obey our parents even as adults? So they're wondering if not obeying your parents when you're adult equates being on that list of sinners.
It's a funny when you read the list, right? Because there's all these things like murder, hating God, and then in the list is disobedient to parents, and you kind of feels a little bit out of place. But I think there's a cultural thing going on there. In Roman culture in the first century, being disobedient to parents is punishable by death. And there's a really strong emphasis in Jewish culture even around the same time of being obedient to parents. There's a high authority structure. Mm-hmm. We're in a culture that's very flat. Children sassing off their parents, disobeying parents, you have no right. Like we so value the individual.
Sure I still wouldn't be here, actually.
So value the individual's authority that no one has authority, even parents in our culture. So it's like shocking that the thought that disobeying your parents would be put alongside, you know, greed and foolishness and maliciousness and deceit and strife and murder. But actually in that culture, it would be. And so we have to recognize that we're on the opposite end of a spectrum. Like probably no other culture has been so rude and disobedient to parents as a value. Just like fight the man.
Now, is that a passage?
And you wonder why teachers can't get any respect in classrooms because it's not even happening.
Now, my question is, is that a passage that is nailed above the beds of your children? You know, is that a devotional you do each night? You're going to memorize this passage.
But the question really is about adult children. Yeah. Does that cease? Does it cease?
So we have. I think we have
if Tyler's dad phones him up and says, "Tyler, sell your house and give me the money," does Tyler, if he doesn't obey that, is he being sinful?
I mean, I think the focus of the passage would be on like family, household situations, and in the Roman culture, a household was a very important unit, a structural unit to all of society. Like society holds together by ordered households, sort of like a Roman idea, right? Greco-Roman idea. So the context, the disobedient to parents, would I believe be speaking about within the household. Now, I think we would also look at, like, scripturally, one of the Ten Commandments, honor your mother and father. And I think that's a call to lifelong
honor.
You know, yeah, you can be moved out of your house for 40 years. You should honor, you're called still to honor your father and mother. So I would say for adult children, are you required to obey your parents? I think you're required to honor them. Mm-hmm. And there's probably a lot that goes with that. I mean, it might mean taking seriously their instructions even when you disagree. I mean, there's a lot of things that are included in honor.
And also, it might mean a role reversal of caring for them when they're older.
Yeah, and yeah, so
which
not
isn't
only
obeying them is actually caring.
You
caring
honor for them in when they need you. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that would be a big part of honoring your parents as well. But I don't know if you could make a case that, like, the adult child, just out of an authority obedience, must always obey their parents. Well, just like we would say we should submit to authorities. Mm-hmm. But then there's examples and times when you should not submit to the authorities, when you have to submit to God instead.
The question is, there's a time in your life when your parents are the authority.
Yes.
And then there's a time in life where they are no longer the authority. It says to leave a man shall leave his father and mother,
yeah,
and start his own family unit. So you can't leave something and still be under that authority.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in the Romans passage, he's making a list of the way that sin goes counter to God's design and, like, this kind of systemic problem of sin. And so one of the examples of that is disrespect and disobedience to those in authority, in this case, in the home. As well as all these other things, go counter to God's design. I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree.
You agree? Is that what you said?
Well, yeah. I mean, you guys pretty much, just the two of you together, said pretty much everything I said when we were planning. So I feel like you stole all my answers. So now I just can agree
totally
with.
Plagiarized
so I essentially that. Agree with myself.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, here's a question that came in a couple weeks ago. Then. Yeah, okay. Yeah, the next one's for Tyler.
Oh, great.
This is a question about communion.
Oh, awesome.
Yep, save that one for Tyler.
Oh, that's
a good question. I have a question about communion. As it's presented in a lot of modern-day church ceremonies, it's a highly ritualized, stylized, spiritualized event with solemn, sad music, liturgical recitations, quiet reflection, etc. To varying degrees for all the above, mm-hmm. depending where you are, right? Mm-hmm. But the writer of this question says, I don't get the sense it started this way. It was Jesus enjoying a meal with his apostles, not a temple event presided over by priests with the dutiful worshipers in a single file to receive their wafer. It was living, breathing meal amongst workers, or so they think. And the elements are far less important than the remembrance. Am I crazy, or would it make more sense to do communion to commune in our community groups and at a mealtime with our families and our church family? I fear we're in danger of loving the ritual more than the meaning. Thoughts and opinions, please.
My answer would be yes. Like,
Tyler's all for it.
He's not making a bad point. I think, I don't know. I don't know if you guys are serious about me taking this question, so I'm just going to go ahead.
Tyler's like all hesitant.
Steve's just giving me the eye, like, you didn't even bring a Bible with you up here.
I got one on the shelf for the free.
But I think he's touched on a few good points. Well, one of them is that I think it's important to remember the key isn't method, it's heart. Mm-hmm. So we've adopted methods. And if you go to different churches, sometimes you'll find the way they do communion incredibly more significant because it's forced you out of your method.
Hmm.
Right? So, for example, I have not been to a church until I started coming here where you went and got communion as opposed to it being brought to you. So I've been finding it significant when we've shared communion as a church family together to actually have someone say to me, Tyler, this is the body of Christ broken for you. Mm-hmm. That I find that there's a rich significance for me because it's not my normal routine. And so another example is like, I'm sure you've been to Mars Hill Church in Seattle. They do communion every Sunday. They do it similar to us, where you go up and receive it. But it's not from a person, I don't think. But
it's from a vending machine?
Well, it's like a table. I can't remember. I'm sure there's people running it, but it was years ago now. But it's a place where you can have wine. with your as communion. You have a choice between wine or juice. And I've been to a few churches. Anglican churches often have wine.
They have both. Yeah.
And for me, I find wine takes me out of my routine because there's a bitterness to wine that I actually think helps me remember the bitterness of Christ's death, his blood spilling. Whereas, because I've just been having juice, grape juice, Welch's grape juice, my whole life at communion, and there's a sweetness to it. So you get used, but the wine was like a smack in the face bit. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So I would say, I don't necessarily think it matters, and the matters of ritual come down to, in some cases, the heart of the person receiving it.
Well, I think you could go either way.
Yeah,
I think
you can have communion in your community group, and that's great.
If it totally disturbs you to have anything rocked about the way you do communion, then my fear would be that you are clinging to the ritual.
Yeah, absolutely.
But under the premise of the meaning.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, you could equally do the opposite problem and take it so casually that you're like, oh, we don't want to do it like this, so that you do it so casually, and you're not giving the heaviness or the maybe heaviness isn't the right word, but the reflection and the respect.
Yeah, and Jesus
warned.
Right?
So I think it's not about I think you could sit around a table of a community group and do it, but it still should be treated with respect because it's about what you're remembering. And now that we've both answered that, we're going to turn to Steve and see what Steve has to say.
I just want to add that the respect is. It depends. Like the thing about respect and showing proper reverence is cultural and it's unique to the person. Mm-hmm. So we have to be really careful when we talk about, oh, someone's not being as reverent. Okay, they have a hat on and they're going to take communion. How dare they? Where reverence is a matter of the heart as well, right? So so we just need to be careful when we talk about this term respect, because sometimes we tie it to mean. My way of being reverent.
What if someone walked in off the street and the Lord had called them and they came forward, not washed, not clothed, came forward with a heart broken and repentant and wanted to take part in communion, and it would make me shudder to think, we'd be like, oh my goodness, they need to go clean up first before they show up at the remembrance table.
I was serving communion years ago at a Good Friday service, and we had a homeless man come into the church, and I'm trying to remember now if it was Good Friday or Easter Sunday, but we did communion. I think it was Good Friday. And an older gentleman who was a leader in the church was serving on the same side of the building as I was, and he wouldn't serve this man.
Oh.
And
that breaks my heart.
And it broke my heart. It did too. And I went over and I served him, and I got an earful after about it from him, from the man who refused. Because in his mind, we couldn't estimate where he was spiritually to give him communion, and I was like,
"But you can't estimate.
That's not on us.
I can't do that to anybody.
I can't do that to you or you. Yeah, yeah. It doesn't matter what he looks like. We like
in a church of 300 people. We don't know the heart and soul of every person. Actually, right? It doesn't have to be a homeless person. Anybody came in and started going like taking handfuls of communion bread and cups full of juice because they're disrespecting it, and they're then I would take that person and go get them food. You know, like, and
let me
be
buy
like,
you a sandwich.
But yeah, but like,
because that's what Jesus would probably do too, right? Like, that's the thing. Like, so it's just a matter of. I think it's just a matter of recognizing on a couple of these issues that I don't think it's not our job to judge the heart of a person necessarily. God ultimately judges the heart. We need to be faithful to extend grace and compassion and Smarties. Whenever necessary.
You want Smarties instead of bread.
What was it? I can't hear you. Do you have something in your mouth?
Anyway. I am not telling.
But we have to be conscious of being graceful and extending grace and allowing God and... Because reality is the work of the Spirit is done between God and the person. Not between the God and us and the person. So God doesn't often go to me and be like, hey, Tyler, I'm going to stir something in you, and you need to tell Steve, or you need to tell Rhoda, or you need to tell somebody, and it's going to change them. I mean, he sometimes acts that way. But I'm rambling. Steve, take it.
I think on that last...
Steve's got a big shovel now. Dig it out.
This is what happens when I take questions. This is going to be the longest podcast ever. This table is staticky. Sorry.
Steve, quick, go.
Okay,
that's all the time we have. Sorry.
I'm just going to pass some more Smarties to our time.
We warn people like we always give a warning. We always give, when we give instructions.
Like so, I mean, a caution.
I can't judge people's heart, but what I can do is warn them. And I feel like we're mm-hmm. biblically mm-hmm. called. So I say, you know, if you're a follower of Jesus, we welcome you. If you're not there yet, you know, pass by or, you know, withhold, and that's okay. We're all there. And we often talk like that. And mm-hmm. so I want to put the onus back on the individual and say, if this is who you are, we'd love for you to come forward. And if it's not where you're at, that's fine. Like, this isn't for you. And in that way, we want to make it clear that we expect the Christians are welcome to celebrate. Those who are following Jesus are welcome to celebrate. And those who aren't there yet, it's okay. Don't feel pressure to come forward. And that way,
I can't talk about each of us reflecting in our own hearts.
Yeah, I can't know who's coming forward. Is this person a genuine follower of Jesus Christ? I don't know that. If we give that instruction, we're putting it on them. So I can't withhold that, but we can instruct that this is who we expect to come forward. The question. There is always a danger of ritualism in anything, baptism, communion, but even in singing, mm-hmm. even in prayer. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can do anything in a way that becomes ritualistic and empty. And
coming to church itself in and of itself can be ritualistic. We're still called to gather
and we're still called to do communion and remember.
I'm saying, Steve was essentially addressing that on Sunday, saying like, sometimes church on Sunday is something we do. And he was trying to call us to, or the text was trying to call us to actually engage in worship, heartfelt worship of Jesus, mm-hmm. right?
I guess I would, maybe the thing I would point out against this question is that communion is a gift from Jesus to the church. Mm-hmm. So I would caution against, like, I'm okay with the community group celebrating communion. But it is a symbol of corporate belonging to Jesus and his church. It's a corporate sign that he has given us as the church. Mm. And so it was meant to be for the body to celebrate together, remembering Christ and his sacrifice, proclaiming the gospel in the act, and anticipating his return. And it's something that he has called us to do. It's one of the kind of that and baptism are the ordinances, right? And this is baptism is the initiating ordinance or sacrament. It's the symbol of beginning the Christian life, and communion is the symbol of continuing in the Christian life. And it's a gift to the church, not to an individual. So I think the heart of communing with each other, I would hesitate about separating too much from the corporate church because that's what it's intended for by Jesus. Mm-hmm. So we go, hey, is it odd that we're doing this as a whole church? And wouldn't it make more sense in a meal in our home? And in some ways, I agree with that. That was closer to what it originally was. And I'd say in the first century, I think that was typical because they met in homes. Mm-hmm. So a large community group would be what a first century church would often look like. You know, the church in Rome was not, they didn't all gather in their building. They were a whole bunch of house churches that were the Church of Rome, and they would celebrate communion and a meal together, right? And this is also the sense you get from 1 Corinthians.
They also probably didn't have 11. Welches.
No. There's a whole story behind that. I don't know if you know that. The Welches was invented for communion.
Really?
During
Prohibition era.
What?
The Welch family invented their grape juice to replicate.
What?
They did it for communion.
Wow.
Anyway, that's a whole other story.
That's genius.
Wow.
They made a lot of money off of it.
So,
I hope they tithe.
It's a church. I'm okay with a community group celebrating communion. I actually struggle with, say, like at a wedding, mm-hmm. husband and wife and no one else celebrating communion.
Yeah.
And I go,
I'm in agreement.
That this is a sign that Jesus gave to the church body and should be celebrated. It's supposed to symbolize our unity with each other and with Christ. That's what the point of it is.
Yeah.
And I think it'll look really, there's freedom to do it there's some freedom to do it in different ways, different forms. Because how do you celebrate this rightly, getting at the right heart of it for 10 people versus 1,000? And, you know, you sitting down over, you could do it over a meal. And I've done that. Our community groups had communion together as part of a meal around Easter time. And that's deeply meaningful. We also do it as a church family. So have we strayed? I think there's a potential to stray anytime we lose the meaning of it.
It was intended as a meal to be eaten as a body, as a church family.
Well, I could see it being feeling like a richer experience for me in a smaller group of people at times. Mm-hmm. But I also think that when I agree with your point of it being part of the collective, I also think, like, sure, is there a risk of it becoming ritualistic for some people? Sure it is. But I'm not responsible for those people. I'm responsible for my heart. And mm-hmm. even if it's being done a certain way in church that Sunday, it's about what the meaning is. And I need to get my heart right before God mm-hmm. and go through the meaning of that rather than going, oh, I'm not comfortable with how they're doing this. Well,
and
I shouldn't be so fixated on how it's being done, but what it is about.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that we've seen kind of even throughout our lifetime is ritual, like, kind of if something is done ritually, like regularly with kind of consistency, you know, 10 years, in the last 10 or 15 years, our culture's kind of backed away from it, or maybe even longer. So, you know, you see some of the liturgical elements in church really kind of foot off the gas in a lot of places. But I think what's happened is we've gotten away from some of the kind of walls that helped maintain consistency in the Orthodox faith. It kind of went weird, I think, for a lot of people.
And well,
there was no kind of like, there was no kind of honing point. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, you look at, I see a lot of people moving back towards some of the liturgical elements, not necessarily moving back toward the Anglican or the Catholic Church because, and I've seen lots of people do that as well, but not in masses, but even churches moving back towards some of the liturgical elements of, you know, the way you read scripture and reading creeds together or responsive readings, some of the things that are kind of trademark of the Anglican Church, and one of them is communion and the way communion is served and done. I think sometimes the structure of the ritual, quote unquote, helps keep us maybe in the right area, like kind of hemmed in a bit where we need to be.
Well, I don't know, but sometimes then you have it's the same a, thing as like, are people sword. Going, yeah, totally, right? And that's the question, because you have people going back, if they're going back to a ritual liturgical, which I don't necessarily have anything against liturgical things, and but like if you have people going back to that because they're looking for something they're missing in their lives and they're looking for it in the ritual and the liturgy, then they're missing the point,
mm-hmm.
right? And that's the point. Like, they need to find, if there is a ritual, let's say, or something liturgical, but that person's, it is helping guide that person's heart to genuine worship yeah. and praise, that's different than them going back just to trying to find some meaning in the actual ritual.
I guess the point I'm trying to make is we've kind of come to buy the myth with communion and some of these things that there's freedom in the non-linear. There's freedom in the randomness. There's freedom in the spontaneity, which is true. And when I talk about freedom, I talk about freedom of in Christ, right? So there's a deeper richness and freedom to non-linear expressions of some of these religious elements, right?
Yeah.
Baptism in the lake, communion under the tree, or at the wedding, or with the community group. Those things aren't bad. But what I'm trying to say is there's also freedom in the linear aspects, that we can experience yeah. a deep richness of faith in the linear aspects of our faith. But the point that Steve is making, which I totally
that
agree with,
making.
Is yeah. that, no, that I know Steve's making, is that communion is meant to bond the believers together for the mutual edification,
given to
the proclamation of yeah. the cross and the mutual edification of the church.
So is baptism.
Right,
I
yeah.
struggle when baptism isn't, is I struggle when baptism or communion are done outside of a church family context.
Yeah.
Because they're given to the church, you know?
I totally agree.
That doesn't mean, so, but like a community group that's all part of the same church family, I think that's different, you know?
Or when a church meets at the ocean.
Oh, yeah, that's fine.
Or the beach.
It's not the building. The buildings are relevant.
No.
But, you know, the communion at wedding, or at the wedding, or even, you know, honestly, baptism at camp.
Yeah.
This is the global church, but this is not your church family. Baptism was always historically a sign of incorporation into a local church family, not into camp.
Yeah.
Baptism's great. I love that kids are getting baptized, but I would say a local church is where you should be baptized, because these are the people that are witnessing, celebrating, holding you accountable, speaking into your lives, welcoming you, you know.
Well, and that's part of the – what you just mentioned is part of the thing that I think we've actually missed a little bit in the church is that and it's something I've always made – I mean, I just came from a Baptist church, so baptism was a pretty significant part of it. It's in the name, so we obviously like it. But I firmly believe and have been entrenched in me from my upbringing is the idea of that baptism and communion are done publicly to represent an accountability.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the only thing.
And if you move, if you do it with a group of people that you have no other connection with.
Right.
Then,
exactly.
The then where's the accountability?
Yeah. So in the sense of like when I see you, Rhoda, take communion or you, Steve, take communion, you're identifying yourself and I'm taking communion. We're identifying each other as believers in Jesus and therefore are literally giving each other the right to speak into one another's lives with critique, rebuke, encouragement, whatever it is that – we're identifying as brothers and sisters in Christ. So this whole idea of like, oh, I'm not, you know, I don't know Steve well enough to call him out for his sin. Well,
if he takes communion, he does. Yeah.
Yeah, like we're brothers in Christ. So if I see Steve stealing from Thrifties, guess what? We're going to talk about it on the podcast. No, but I'm gonna.
Woo, Tyler's going to stalk you all week to forget something juicy for the podcast next week.
I should be compelled to rebuke you because we've shared the bread and blood of Christ together.
After you paid for his groceries.
No,
that's an excellent point because communion is not about you and God. It's not a private little exchange between you and God.
My point.
And the church just happens to be the vending machine providing the tools for you and God to do business.
A7.
Now, clearly God is involved, and you need to make sure
you're
your
responsible
heart is right with God.
Between
But it's actually a corporate public proclamation. If I'm taking communion,
like
I'm
baptism,
publicly
yeah.
saying yeah. that I belong to Christ and his people.
Yeah.
That's really good. So it's not just something like you're doing communion on your own, like I suppose, but really it's a
maybe
public
if you're living in the
proclamation.
Woods by yourself.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that
I belong to Christ.
That my friend Andy and I did, my former colleague of mine did, when we were doing baptisms, was the way our church sanctuary was set up was the baptism was in the center, and there was doors, and then there's a foyer, and then there was doors that lined up with the sanctuary doors right out to the street.
Mm-hmm.
So we would say when it came time to do baptisms, swing the doors open. Because we're together as a church. Like, we're together. This is about doing this together, holding each other accountable. But this is a public identification with Christ. And, of course, the church building's public. But there's something – we found there's a deep richness in actually saying, no, this is public.
Not behind closed doors.
And I think that's why some of these churches – we've seen, Village Church, for example. They'll go – well, they also don't have a building or a baptismal.
Yeah.
But they'll go down to White Rock Beach. And they'll
– I like
but
it.
But the whole church will go.
Yeah,
and so that's still a church event.
It's a church, and the church is. But what happens is I've been down there when it's been going on, and it's
there's a lot of people watching.
There's a lot of people,
and you get and these
confident.
Days you could have people YouTubing you.
Well, yeah, but in the sense of like you might have 1,000 people that are a part of your community, but there's a guarantee that you're going to have another. If it's a sunny day in summer and you're smart about it, you're going to have another 300 to 1,500 bystanders.
Yeah,
witnessing. What's going on?
Mm. Okay, well,
so
I want
to communicate. Sorry,
I forgot to time this today, so I'm a little worried about it. So
okay,
we probably need to
wrap up
soon.
I'd say there's kind of three, just off my head, three ways to celebrate communion, and I really think there's advantages to each of them. So, the writer of the question thinking about in the home with your family or church family, I think there's a great advantage to celebrating communion as a community group.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It could almost take
the
accountability even feel higher.
Yeah, so it is a higher accountability. There's a richness in because of communion is inherently relational,
mm-hmm.
and you have the richest of relationships with your community group that you're growing together with and you're bonding together and you're holding each other to account. And so I think there's some good advantage of celebrating over a meal because of the richness of your relationships will lend to a richer experience. I think the method where we pass it out to the individual in the pew, I think I like about that we all eat at simultaneously, eat and drink. So there's a symbol of corporate unity as we all literally drink
in
the exact same second, right? There's a symbol of unity there. To me, the downside of the first one is it's just it's not the whole church family. It's just your community group.
Mm-hmm.
The downside of the one where we pass it out is maybe that it feels a little bit individual and,
more passive. Yeah.
And just me, though everyone's doing it. No one, like, you just, the person beside you passed you the plate. You took it out yourself. You kind of, there's no, so I feel like it's a little bit individual that way, but more corporate in another way, in that you're all eating at the same time. Mm-hmm. Coming forward, I like that it's active. Mm-hmm. You have to get up out of your seat. It doesn't come to you. You go to it. And in standing and walking forward, it's more of a public proclamation. I belong to Christ and his people. I'm going forward to do this. I have to choose to do this versus the person beside you handed it to you and you just took it because it went by. Yeah. I like that someone looks you in the eye and says, this is the body of Christ broken for you. I find that deeply meaningful. Yeah. And that the active response together. And so I think my point is there, I actually don't know of one perfect way to capture all the richness of communion. And I think there's different ways and different positives, upsides to each of them. But I think in each of the ways, the key is we got to be getting at the heart of what this is all about, and in a way that isn't just ritualistic, but is historic.
Yeah.
And respectful.
And you know what? I think it's important to maybe mention, don't not do one for the benefit of the other. So that may not be any clearer.
That didn't make any sense.
It didn't make any sense.
Don't take a stand against one.
So the question this guy asked, in the sense of why not do it in the context of a community group? My pastoral advice would be go for it.
Yeah.
Go for it. But don't do it in place of communion with us on Sunday.
Yep.
So we're going to have communion on Sunday. Don't let that, don't pass on taking communion with your church family because on Monday or Thursday, whatever night your community group meets, you took communion together. Mm-hmm. Like, so don't do one to replace the other. Go for it, but...
I guess I'd warn against... I think sometimes we've seen people elevating the method they were raised with.
Mm.
And I've seen it on both sides, like kind of more mainline, or people that were raised with a certain formula, and that becomes sacred to them because it's meaningful to them. And I've seen it from opposite sides. Like,
oh, yeah.
Like, I've had... Our church is a really diverse group of backgrounds, right? And they each bring it, and they each tell me what they like and don't like about communion the way we do it right now. And so I'd say don't elevate that one way to like this is the way, when especially since none of us were doing it the way Jesus did.
Yeah.
We all have to recognize that unless we're celebrating a Passover meal with 11 Jewish men, you know, and we're drinking
Instagram
real wine.
That. If you're doing that, Instagram.
We're
that.
Drinking. We're drinking real wine.
Yeah.
And we're eating unleavened bread, and it's the Passover meal on Passover night, and then you're going to go get crucified. Like, none of us are doing it the way Jesus did. We're all trying in different ways. We're trying to capture what Jesus was calling us to as best we can. But there's no singular. This is the biblical way. No.
And I think there's a bit. If we're really honest, sometimes we get in the church, I think people might disagree with what I'm going to say, but once I explain it, they're not going to...
So send in your questions.
Yeah. I'm going to wrap it up now and tell people to send in their questions.
I'm just going to say that we rely a bit on the mysticism, that we kind of think the elements themselves have mystic qualities, or the method that the words are said, or the order with which they're said, or how we go about practicing certain components of the Christian faith. We kind of get into this mystic
mindset. Well, that's like the religion of it. That's our effort.
The religious. Right? But I think if we're honest, we actually think that those methods have power. You know what I mean? Like the communion bread has power.
Yeah.
No, it's McGavin's white kind of the little square pieces.
Well, it's just McGavin's.
Yeah. I hope it's McGavin's because their bread is delicious. Looking for a sponsorship.
We are going to wrap it up. I'm wrapping it up. Boys,
go see
send your sponsorship inquiries to B-Side.
So, but send your questions. We love these questions. So, bside@twasalliance.org, email us. And we look forward to going through more of our questions we have here next week.
Da-da-da, da-da-da.
Da-da-da, da-da-da.
Bye-bye.
See ya.
Ba-da-da, da-da-da. Bom, 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 bom. Da-da-da, da-da-da, da-da-da.